Farming is a tough business, but it can be hard to see the toll that it takes. Farmers often work alone, and when problems arise, they can feel isolated, with nowhere to turn for help. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Farming is a stressful occupation with a unique set of challenges. This hour, we'll talk about how the stresses of the job, Iowa's rural culture, and a lack of access to health care can combine to create dangerous situations that can even lead to suicide. This hour, new research sheds light on this serious problem. We'll hear from those who are trying to help, and one woman will tell her family's story. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. In this country, we idealize the lives of farmers. Good old-fashioned hard work, growing the food that feeds the world, spending days out in the fresh air and going to bed tired. And there is something to that, as many farmers will tell you. But on the flip side, farming is a stressful occupation with a unique set of challenges, physical, financial, and emotional. This hour, we'll talk about how the stresses of the job, Iowa's rural culture, and a lack of access to health care can combine to create dangerous situations that too often lead to suicide. Later in the hour, I'll talk with a researcher who's trying to understand this problem and people who are doing their best to help farmers who are struggling. But my first guest this hour understands these problems all too well. Jenny Peters lost her husband, Matt, to suicide just over 3 years ago. They'd lived together for more than three decades on their farm outside of Perry. Jenny, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And I know this is a difficult story to share, and I appreciate your willingness to share it with us. The farm that you lived on with your husband was a family farm. This is a farm that had been passed down in his family?
Yes, that's correct. It was a century farm.
And how large was it?
Well, we farmed, when Matt died, we farmed about 1,500 acres. But we didn't own all of it, but that was the amount of acreage that he farmed.
Okay. And the two of you had reached retirement age. You retired from your job at the library in Perry, and Matt was also exploring retirement. But that's a very challenging time for a lot of farmers. What were some of the problems he was facing?
Well, we looked at retirement quite a few years prior to his death, and Matt was always a planner, and he said, you know, we need to plan for this so that, you know, that we do things correctly. We wanted to make sure that the farm was in good hands and that we could retire and do things that we wanted, always wanted to do. So we had actually looked at this for a very long time, and I retired in January of the year that he died, and then he died in the spring.
You have two children, and neither one of them wanted to take over the farm, right?
That's correct, yes. They were both, at the time that he died, they were adults and through school and had professions of their own in different states, which we encouraged. We encouraged them to do it, follow their dream, do what they wanted to do with their life.
So as you were searching for other ways to pass on the farm, I think for people who reach retirement age, it can be a very challenging time for a lot of people in a lot of different careers. But in farming, I think it's probably one of the most challenging, because not only are you looking at your own financial security, your own future, your own plans for the future, but you also have a relationship with this land that you farm. Was Matt concerned about what would happen to this century farm, this part of his family's history?
Right. That you've exactly expressed it exactly correctly. The farmer feels a real connection to the land. It's just a part of their life, and they've, you know, become intimately connected with it all the years that they farmed it. They think about the people who went before him, who worked so hard for it. And so he was very happy that someone else farmed where we were, if it was not a family member. But he was concerned about the person that would do that, that we wanted to make sure it was a smooth transition. So we did do a lot of planning for it.
Right. And from what I know about your story, it sounds like you did everything that you could to try to come up with a good plan.
Mm-hmm. We did. We thought we were on the right path. And honestly, the things that happened to my husband were so happened so quickly that I really only knew that something was very wrong on the last day of his life. It was a very quick downward spiral that just stuns me even today how fast I realized that he was really in trouble that last day.
Well, and I know you don't want to go into the specifics of what exactly was going on, but you had made a plan that you were feeling comfortable with, at least at the start, for passing on this land, and things started to go wrong.
Yes, and that was definitely a factor. And it just added more stress to what he was already going through. But there were other factors. I've had many wonderful people who have helped me through this, and I have realized that there are a combination of things that probably contributed to what happened, some of which I still don't understand. What really surprised me, I think, about all of it is that he didn't fit any of the typical predictors of that one thinks about when one thinks of suicide. Every time I looked at studies or people's lists of things to look for, Matt never fit it. He never fit any of them until I realized that he fit two. He was male, and he was a farmer, and also he was 55. That's another kind of predictor. That's a real growing group of, we think a lot about teenagers and how devastating that is for our young people to take their lives that way, but it's a big concern for the middle-aged person. And if they're male and farming, then those are predictors. So I just couldn't see. It just didn't fit together for me. Right. He was not depressed. There were no drugs or alcohol in his system. We didn't have any financial problems or marital problems. So I was just really at a loss as to what had happened so quickly and so rapidly to him. Some of which I think today, I really think a lot of it could have been chemical reactions, some chemical things that he may have worked with, some perhaps genetics. I just think that it's a field that hasn't been studied nearly enough for us to understand what really happened.
Right, and we will talk a lot more about that as the hour goes on, people who are doing research to try to understand this. From your perspective, again, he did not have a history of diagnosed depression, and from your perspective, no history of undiagnosed depression either. And
correct.
And in piecing together what happened, you see this downward spiral as taking place so quickly over the course of, what, 3 days?
About 3 days, and really only the last day. What I noticed was he wasn't sleeping. There was this really no sleep, and very, he told me, I remember he stood in our farmhouse and looked at me and he said, I feel paralyzed. And he knew that last day, he asked me if our health insurance would cover this kind of coverage because he said, my nerves are shot and I can't think. And so he made an appointment to see our family doctor, and he also made an appointment to see Dr. Michael Roseman, who helps with agricultural wellness and the well-being of farmers. So we were making steps to try to get some help, and the sad thing is that we didn't get it fast enough, I guess. I mean, even though he went to the doctor that day, and it just wasn't to be.
Did he leave you a note? Did he try to explain what happened to you?
Yes, he did. He left. He actually left me a letter, a very long, two-page letter on legal paper, and very explicit, very detailed, and I showed it. I know I showed it to my family physician, who looked at me and he said, "Jenny, that's a love letter," and it was. It was very beautiful, and he said, he just explained that he had torment in his head. And I find those words, people that do have, they attempt suicide, a lot of times they will talk afterwards and say that there was this pain, this incredible pain. And he said, I just have this pain and this, he called it torment. I have torment in my head. And he also gave me very good directions on what to do with the farm, typical for a farmer, who should farm the ground, And then he left meticulous notes for this person of what had been done where, and maps and so forth, of so that person could take over quite seamlessly.
Wow. With a suicide, even if there is a letter or a note, the question of why can never really be answered. That's something that a person takes away with them. In trying to understand it and reaching out to others, you have found a surprising number of other women who have also lost their husbands this way, haven't you?
Yes, I have. And it's a real comfort to see someone, to look in someone's eyes, and they look in yours, and you realize that you have, even though you don't know each other, all of a sudden you know each other really well. And it's a great help to do this. But what I want to do is stand up for my husband since he can't, and to try to help the communities to realize how serious this can be. If you have a farmer who's anxious, who can't sleep, it's urgent. You need to really address it right away.
You also feel very strongly about how people talk about suicide. You don't like the phrase commit suicide because you want to take away some of the stigma of that as well. A lot of people take their lives, and that doesn't make
right.
them a criminal.
I think words are extremely important, and there are so few things in this world that are as have so much stigma as suicide does. So anything that we can do to help people to talk about it freely and comfortably is going to be great. And so from my personal perspective, and I don't speak for everyone, but I don't like the phrase commit because commit suicide because it implies that there was a moral wrong, that implies that there was a crime. And I feel that he died of this just as if someone may have died of heart disease or someone may have died of cancer. I feel that my husband died of this and that it wasn't a crime. So that's my personal preference. And I also want to bring suicide out of the darkness, which is kind of a slogan for international survivors of suicide. They also have walks that are called Bring Suicide Out of the Darkness, which is a lovely phrase. We need to talk about it. This needs to be talked about so that we can make some progress about it and we can feel like there was nothing shameful, that we shouldn't hide it, that it's okay to say that your husband, your father, your son died of suicide.
Well, Ginny, thank you so much for telling your story to us today.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
Ginny Peters lost her husband, Matt, to suicide just over 3 years ago. They farmed together outside of Perry for many decades. This hour, we're talking about the mental health needs of farmers and the risks for suicide and even homicide. We'll continue our conversation this hour. I'll talk with Michael Roseman, who is a farmer and a clinical psychologist. He is also the executive director of Agri Wellness. I will talk with Wendy Riggenberg, who's been conducting research on occupational homicide and suicide in farmers and other agricultural populations. And we'd also love to hear your stories and your questions this hour. Join the conversation at 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about mental health care needs of farmers. We have known for a long time that the suicide rate among male farmers is higher than that of the male general population. We haven't had a lot of detailed information about that, and we will have more detailed information on that as the hour goes on. Joining me now are two people who have given this situation a lot of thought and have done a great deal of research. Michael Roseman is a farmer. He's also a clinical psychologist. He's the executive director of Agri Wellness. Hello, Michael.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
And thank you for asking me to participate.
And Wendy Riggenberg is also with us. She's conducted research into occupational homicide and suicide in farmers and agricultural populations. Hello, Wendy.
Hello. Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
And Michael, I know that you grew up on a farm in Harlan, Iowa, near Harlan, Iowa.
That's right.
And you went away for education. You decided to return to the state after your education. You and your wife came back to live in Iowa. At what point did you start to think about mental health needs of farmers? Was there something that caught your attention?
Well, there were several things that led my wife and I to return to Iowa. After we completed our graduate educations, I took a position at the University of Virginia, where I was an assistant professor of psychology. We left Virginia to return to Iowa and made an active choice to live on the farm, partly because we wanted to farm, but more importantly because I sensed a need that someone had to take care of the, I would like to call it, behavioral health of the agricultural people. And that was, I felt, a calling that I needed to respond to. And since 1979, this has been my pursuit, that is, to understand what makes people farm and how we can better help people who produce food and fiber to take care of themselves behaviorally, and especially to do something about the problem of self-imposed death.
You have coined a term called agrarian imperative.
Yes.
And you've written quite extensively about this, but it's a belief that some people have a genetic predisposition to farm?
Well, all of us carry a little bit of a genetic imperative to produce food because food is an essential for life. And all of us, in varying degrees, will do what it takes to feed our families and our communities and the larger human population. But the people who actively farm as a chosen way of life, I think, especially exhibit the agrarian imperative. I do believe it's a drive similar to territoriality in animal species to acquire the necessary resources to raise a family and to produce what it takes to ensure survival of the species.
I bring that up because as you were looking at rural communities in Iowa and looking at farmers and thinking about their behavior, you were looking at this agrarian imperative, but also a unique culture that surrounds farming. And I think it's important to try to understand this culture as we also try to understand these risk factors. Can you give me a little bit of an idea of some of the things about this culture that define it?
Well, first of all, there are several lines of reasoning which I think validate the construct of agrarian imperative, and the one is the genetic contributions. I could go more into that, but let me bring up the psychological evidence from research, because that's what I think you're leaning toward mm-hmm. hearing about. Studies of farm people in Australia, Great Britain, and the U.S. all seem to come up with the same traits or characteristics that define successful farmers. These are people who are able to put up with incredible adversity. They work terribly hard, are also, though, somewhat risk-taking in their behaviors, and are capable of making their own decisions and working in isolation if necessary. Now, these are characteristics of successful farmers. There also are some dimensions of these traits that perhaps set up persons involved in farming to be at more risk because they don't verbalize well what is going on internally and how they feel. I think they tend to struggle because they think that this is my chosen way of life. It's what I'm called to do. So the characteristics that make us successful also work against us because we reach out for assistance too late.
Oh,
and I think Jenny made that point.
Right. I want to bring Wendy Riggenberg into the conversation as well. And Wendy, I know that you also grew up on a farm.
I did. My family lives on a century farm outside of Belle Plaine.
And what made you start thinking about the risk factors for farmers?
Well, my personal experiences include that, you know, my great-grandfather had been gored by a bull and died later from those injuries. And then my grandfather was injured in a power takeoff and later died from those injuries. And I've just always felt a very personal connection to agriculture and agricultural safety. So when I started pursuing that at the University of Iowa, my associate professor, who was the head of my thesis, Marizin Ramirez, she had said, you know, we could really look at some injury issues, or we could look at intentional harm issues. So we took a look at intentional harm, whether that was suicide or homicide in the farming populations.
Well, and when we think about intentional harm in this population, Michael, immediately most of us think about the farm crisis. That was such a very difficult time in the state of Iowa, and any of us who lived through that time remember some of the horror stories of things that took place. There was the man in Hills who killed a neighbor, who killed the president of a bank, killed his wife, and then took his own life. I mean, that is an absolutely horrific case, but there were many other serious, dangerous situations that arose out of the stress of the farm crisis as well. And I know that you were helping people during that time.
That is correct. We learned a lot from the farm crisis because during the years when people were most economically stressed, the rate of self-imposed death rose to about four times the usual rate of suicide among male farmers. It did also go up among females in the agricultural settings, but it was primarily a male phenomenon. And we know that whenever there is a threat to the livelihood that we strive so hard to achieve, that is working the land and doing these noble things of producing food and fiber, whenever those aims are threatened, we become more at risk for intentional harm.
And it's not just suicide that we're talking about here either, and not even a homicide as well. I mean, when we're talking about the needs that these individuals had, I mean, there were a lot of things going on during the farm crisis that cropped up because of this tremendous stress, including domestic violence, right?
Well, I think that is correct. Both the rate of divorce and domestic violence went up dramatically during the farm crisis of the 1980s. In terms of other ways of harming people, Wendy can perhaps speak to this with some data. What I can say is that often farm people are more inclined to take out their frustrations or their, let's say, punish themselves rather than to harm others, although there certainly are instances such as the situation at the Hills Bank,
right,
that you brought up.
This hour, we're talking about the mental health needs of those in the agricultural community and some of the tremendous challenges that farmers face. With me this hour, Michael Roseman. He is a farmer and a clinical psychologist. He's the executive director of AgriWellness. And researcher Wendy Riggenberg. She's been conducting research into occupational homicide and suicide in farmers and agricultural populations, research that is forthcoming. It will be published in the next month, right, Wendy?
We're hoping to get the article sent out within the next month, and hopefully it'll be in a publication in the next 6 months. Research always takes a while to get through the proper channels.
All right. Well, I appreciate your willingness to give us a preview of that research today. And Wendy, in doing your research, you faced a lot of challenges in trying to figure out this population because it's hard to identify information about farmers. Why is that?
Well, it is interesting. And one thing that I guess I hadn't necessarily anticipated, We were given access to the Census of Fatality in Occupational Illness and Injury data out of the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And what we found, number one, only 45% of farmers claim that as their primary occupation. And that reflects that so many farmers not only farm, but they work off the farm as well to help, you know, we can anticipate that they generate an income so that they are allowed to farm. So we've got 65% of farmers who are, you know, doing things other than just farming, which of course increases stress. So we had to capture those numbers, as well as we wanted to look at agricultural workers and how are farmers and agricultural workers similar or different in this aspect of homicide and suicide. Agricultural workers are categorized in a different category. So we had to work hard to pull together these two groups that are in different categories, as well as the Bureau of Labor Statistics had changed their occupational coding system. So we ended up needing to combine two groups, which was, in my opinion, one of the greatest benefits of the research that I'm offering to get 19 years of data. However, it's also one of the greatest limitations because we are taking two groups that have been categorized differently and then trying to pull them together.
So you're saying that, you're talking about all agricultural workers, not just farmers.
Correct.
But
correct.
Other people who also work on farms.
Correct. And one of the reasons was that the Bureau of Labor Statistics puts farmers in a management category, but they're also in there with forestry workers and fisheries. And to me, that was just a little bit different than what I wanted to look at. I really wanted to look at a group of people who were invested in using the land to grow food and or livestock.
And when you started digging deep and you were able to uncover some of these numbers, and again, you were looking at suicide and homicide rates, but you were separating those out?
Correct. We looked at both homicide and suicide rates because, of course, previous research has shown that farmers historically have an increased suicide rate when compared to other occupations. And coming from a farming family, I understand that the farmer lives and works at their place of occupation. So how is that different? And what are the other risk factors that go along with that versus someone who goes to a factory and clocks in and clocks out and then comes home and has a pretty separate professional to personal life?
Right. And you also focused on men.
What we found was that men were certainly more prevalent in the suicide category.
And that's true in the general population
as well.
All right. And so it's easier to focus on those statistics because you have a more comparable sample?
Because we had greater numbers, and the greater numbers lend themselves to better statistical analysis.
And also with greater numbers, you're also identifying a greater risk.
Correct.
As well. Well, so tell me what you found looking at this period of time. And you said, 19 years?
19 years of data. Some of what we found, farmers and agricultural workers in the combined category, they are about 3.6 is my statistic, 3.6 times more likely to commit suicide versus all other occupations.
Wow. And sort of the general understanding, not during the farm crisis, but you know, Michael was just talking about numbers mm-hmm. a few minutes ago. The general understanding has been that they are about two times more likely to commit suicide than the general population. Were you surprised by the 3.6?
Really very surprised. And it ranged, you know, when we looked at each year individually, it ranged from about 1.5 times more likely to almost 6 times more likely, just with an average of, you know, 3.6, or you know, so between 3 and 4 times more likely to commit suicide than all other occupations. So it was surprising, but at the same time, I think it really brings home the point of, yeah, there is an issue here, and we need to be looking into this much more in depth, and we need to be looking and planning and funding for interventions.
What about homicide rates? I mean, you focused on intentional harm, so we're talking about suicide. What about homicide?
What we found was that homicide rates were consistently lower than all other occupations. So while it's not, you know, in comparison, it doesn't rise to the level of being, you know, as much of a concern as suicide, I think the personal impact of homicide rates, of homicide as an issue, is certainly something that lends itself to be looked at further. It also kind of confirms previous research that says intentional harm, when you put suicide and homicide together in the categories, you know, the anticipation was that it varies inversely. So if you have a higher suicide rate, you're going to have a lower homicide rate. And I found that for some years. I did find some regional differences that I think are very intriguing and should be looked at a little bit further.
And let's just get a tiny snapshot of those regional differences. And let's talk about, boy, looking at your charts, the Midwest versus the South is a very interesting contrast.
Correct. So in the Midwest, we have a much lower percentage rate of homicides versus suicides, whereas in the South, we have a much higher homicide rate versus suicides.
Interesting. Very interesting. Well, we will talk more about that in a moment, and also some of the other risk factors on the farm, including access to ways to end your life, which is something that makes it easier for farmers to commit suicide than those in other occupations. My guests right now are Wendy Riggenberg. She's conducted research into occupational homicide and suicide in farmers and agricultural populations. Michael Roseman is here. He is a farmer and a clinical psychologist. He is also the executive director of AgriWellness. We'll continue this conversation in a moment, and we'd like to hear from you as well. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the mental health needs of farmers. And in particular, we're talking about the increased risk of farmers of committing suicide or even homicide, although suicide rates, as we just heard from Wendy Riggenberg, a researcher who has conducted research into occupational suicide in farmers and agricultural populations, is 3.6 times. The risk is 3.6 times the rate of the general population among male farmers. And also with me is Michael Roseman. He is a farmer and a clinical psychologist. And Michael, I know that during the farm crisis of the 1980s, as you were trying to help individuals, you also created a network. You tried to create opportunities for farmers to reach out and ask for help when they were in trouble. Is there, you were talking earlier about the cultural things that define our rural communities in Iowa and elsewhere, and asking for help is not an easy thing for a lot of farmers to do, is it?
You're right.
So how did you try to give them an avenue to ask for help? Was there anything specific to what you were creating to make it easier to get over that hurdle?
Well, my earlier work during the farm crisis of the 80s was largely to understand what were the factors that were linked with the need for mental health treatment and assistance. We didn't at that time, I didn't start a telephone hotline service. A number of states started services that they called farmer-friendly hotlines or helplines. Many of the states in the Midwest that develop such options include Iowa, which has to this day the Iowa Concern Hotline, but Nebraska has the Nebraska Rural Family Hotline, and there are other hotlines around, but many of them have had to cease operation because there is no funding available to keep them going. So Wendy brings up a very good point that we need to address a significant cause of harm to the well-being of farmers, and we're not looking at the issues well. We do know that farm people will contact confidential, free hotlines and helplines, yet we can't get the funding to maintain a much-needed service.
Now, there are suicide hotlines available. Why do you believe that we need to have a separate kind of crisis line for farmers?
Because you hinted at it earlier, and when you said that there is a culture of people who farm, that culture is very potent. People will reach out for assistance from others who understand the unique travail that they're going through. Often farmers will not find the usual channels to be credible because they don't understand the pressures that go on with farming, but they will reach out to their veterinarians, sometimes to a neighbor who is also a farmer. So we know that farmers will reach out to people whom they feel will understand their culture and background.
Interesting. Well, I want to bring Margaret Van Ginkel into the conversation, and she is with the Iowa Crisis Concern Hotline. Hello, Margaret.
Hello.
And tell me, in running the Iowa Concern Hotline, who reaches out to you?
Well, a variety. You know, Iowa Concern, we hear from people, from farmers and a variety of people, not just farmers anymore. But a lot of times when we look at the rural community, it may be a spouse or a friend of a person they're concerned about that may call first, and then they try to call, get that person they're concerned about to call. And we try to train our operators. I mean, originally when Iowa Concern was set up in 1985, most of the operators had been farmers or were farmers. But since then, we don't have as many that really are still farming. But we try to train them with some of the, like Mike was talking about, some of the culture of farmers. So when they're talking to a farmer, they can do some farm talking with them. And that we have found is so important, that the farmers realize, and in counseling too, that someone they're talking to has some of that farm background.
What can you offer them when they call?
Well, the first thing is just being a good listener. You know, the operators are and the counselors are trained to be good listeners and to, you know, let them talk and share what they're concerned or stressed about. Then our counselors will watch for clues that, you know, if there are some suicide clues, try to talk them into, you know, seeing a counselor. And I think many times, you know, most people that call the hotlines, we have very few people that are suicidal right then, but because probably they're calling to ask for help, whether they know it or not. Sometimes they call and they have a legal question, which we have an attorney that works on the line. And then after, you know, after the attorney talks with them about the legal question, then he finds out, you know, they're highly stressed and they really need some more mental health type counseling, and we can refer them to some of those people.
Are there things that happen that seem to indicate that there will be an uptick in the number of people calling for help? Are there signs that you look for?
Well, I think, and right now, you know, last couple of years have been kind of quiet with the rule. I think financial issues, you know, that's the big thing. If farmers are under stress with the finances and the livestock prices have gone down, you know, we've had different times in the last few years where the dairy prices and so have been really low, and it's better right now.
So you keep an eye on commodities markets to...
Right, right. And you can kind of tell, you know, or the cattle market if it's down, or the weather conditions is another thing, you know, when there's a drought out there or there's a flood that, you know, the crops have been damaged, and maybe, yes, you know, they've gone through all this work to put them in and then have to replant and get flooded out again, that sometimes that's just a little more stress than what that average farmer can take.
How many calls do you estimate you would get over a period of say, a month?
We get probably around 800 calls is what we're getting right now, but not. I would say only right now about 12% of those may be from rural farm people right now, last year or two. Like I said, it's kind of quiet, and, of course, prices have been better. However, you get some people, you know, when we say that, oh, everybody's doing great if you're a farmer today, but then you get a few people that still aren't doing really well, and that's even more of a concern for suicide, I think, because they feel really isolated. You know, they look around, everybody else is buying a new combine or new pickup, and they're thinking, what's wrong with me? How come we aren't making as much money on our farm and aren't able to do those things? So they feel even more isolated sometimes in when there are good conditions.
Right. Well, Margaret, thank you so much for talking with us today.
You're welcome.
Margaret Van Ginkel, who runs the Iowa Concern Hotline, and Michael Roseman, as you were saying, you started to create a network of these Sowing the Seeds of Hope hotlines around the country. Many of them have shut down because of a lack of funding. And that must be frightening to you.
Well, it is, because we have made good progress to reduce the physical perils of farming. Equipment is designed with more safety features. There's been a lot of education done to help people know what to avoid and how to protect ourselves. But we haven't looked at all at what Wendy is indicating is a higher rate of death due to psychological reasons than to physical reasons.
I want to go back to the phone. Sam is on the line in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Sam.
Hello.
Hi. What did you want to bring up today?
Well, one thing that I remember, I grew up on a farm, and farming was in the family. I currently work in an office, though. But my grandmother lived alone as the farmer. And beside a neighbor who was a couple miles away that she didn't really like, she didn't really have a lot of company. And when I'm in an office, I'm surrounded by people all day long who all know what my workload is. They know all the pressures that I'm feeling about my job because they're probably feeling the same pressures as well. And I think that with farming, you're a lot more physically isolated than you would be in any other kind of job, in that nobody immediately around you is going to really get a full throttle of what your workload is and what all of your stresses are. And that feeling of alone could probably play a pretty large factor.
Well, Sam, thank you so much for bringing that up. And that returns us to the idea of isolation. But it also brings up the fact that if you work with other people, if you're surrounded by other people and they start to be concerned about you, you also come into contact with them again. So farmers, even if somebody else is worried, they may not see that person for another week or so. I mean, Michael, there is a lot of isolation.
There is. It has changed, though. The telephone, the cell phone, the computer have linked farmers a lot more with resources and with entities that have a role in the success of the farm, like a commodity broker or an animal nutritionist or whatever resources are needed. There still is more social isolation among people who engage in farming and ranching than most other occupations. That makes it more important for farmers to realize what is going on with themselves and to take steps to try to deal with the impending depression or thoughts of self-harm.
And we've talked a lot, and I'd love for both of you to weigh in on this. We've talked a lot about the isolation and the incredible level of responsibility of a farmer financially and physically for land and for livestock, et cetera. But there are other things about the farming environment that make it very stressful. And Wendy, I mean, some of those are noise, smells, the fact that, that you are interacting now on farms with increasing numbers of livestock, if you're a livestock farmer. Mm-hmm. I mean, what are some of the other things that make farming so very stressful?
Boy, there's a lot of them. There's, of course, long hours in working in heat and cold and noise and vibration, lots of odors, different particulate emissions, as well as different environmental pollutants. So those are just the physical factors. And then, of course, when you look at other occupational stress, people are managing their own company, they're relying on themselves and really performing a lot of the work by themselves. What if they get ill? What if their livestock becomes ill? You know, and I think Mike had already talked about what if they have to replant in their crop? Long work days, few vacation days. What happens if they have to care for another family member? What happens if, you know, as the family, they were running the farm together in this, you know, family farm, and then you've got to get along with everybody really well? Or if you don't, well, there's another aspect of stress. So we've seen that there's a lot of relationship between increased stress that also causes an increased risk for injury. And of course, injury then also causes more stress and more workload ability, right. You know, that varies.
And earlier in the hour, Ginny brought up her concerns about chemical exposure that her husband may have had. That's an area where there are a lot of questions, right, Michael?
Yes, there are very serious concerns that insecticides in particular, those that increase the transmission of nervous signals from one nerve cell to another. Many of the insecticides kill insects that way. Well, the insecticide affects the human nervous system in the same way, so that people become overly aroused, can't stop from ruminating, can't sleep, find themselves feeling, as Ginny said, emotionally paralyzed. And we have much greater need for research on some of these chemical families, but we're not getting all the research done that needs to be undertaken.
And we're nearly out of time. And Wendy, your research is so important in showing us how great this risk is. Again, 3.6 times the rate of people in the general population for suicide. What, I know you have a lot of questions that remain, but for those of us listening today, what is the takeaway? What should we think about if we have farmers in our lives or work on a farm ourselves?
Well, I guess I've got two takeaways from my research that I want to get out there. First of all, people who are more at risk for suicide are, of course, white and male, but they're over 35, they're self-employed, and we identify them by finding their body in a farm building. People who are more at risk of homicide for the farmers and agricultural workers are white, male, they're 25 years of age or older, so a little bit younger, and they work for pay on a farm. So there really is a distinct difference, and we see, and we can, I guess, anticipate that it's being the self-employed that really causes the option of taking one's own life as something that, that the person chooses as, gosh, I think this is the best way to handle my circumstance. So as it is an option, we really need to look at how do you intervene, when do you intervene, and of course the funding mechanism. You know, contact your local representatives and say, we really need to invest in the mental health and well-being of our farmers. They're, you know, the backbone of America.
Wendy, thank you so much. Wendy Riggenberg has conducted research into occupational suicide and homicide in farmers and agricultural populations. And Michael Roseman, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Michael Roseman is a farmer and a clinical psychologist. He's the executive director of AgriWellness. I'm Charity Nebbe. Talk of Iowa is produced by Iowa Public Radio News.